From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette, and you're listening to Idaho Matters. It is Friday, so it's time for our reporter roundtable. Of course, we're going to get you up to date on all of the news that made headlines this last week. Today, our panel includes Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, Will Walke, reporter for the Mountain West News Bureau, as well as Wyoming Public Media, and Troy Oppie, host of All Things Considered, right here on Boise State Public Radio News. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Jim.
Yes, indeed.
So we are just getting word that there is a verdict in the criminal trial of Lori Vallow Daybell. We've been told that they will read that verdict live at 12:45. We will do our best at 12:45 to bring that audio up and to share that with our listeners. But with that said, I do want to talk about what happened yesterday in court. So, Troy, we're talking 4 weeks of testimony, 60 witnesses, and then I believe late yesterday afternoon, the jury finally got to decide the verdict. So it went to the jury late yesterday afternoon. Troy, you spent yesterday in the courtroom. So let's start there with closing arguments. But first off, kind of set the scene for us yesterday, because I happened to just drive by the courthouse yesterday morning, and there was a massive line outside of the courthouse, I'm assuming, with folks wanting to be inside that courtroom.
Yeah, I was in that line. And to be specific, I was not in the courtroom yesterday. I was in the overflow room, which was the most crowded it has been. And it wasn't close, according to the bailiff in that room. That's assigned to kind of watch over everyone, make sure general decorum stays in place, and make sure people are following the restriction on recording video, audio, on taking no photographs in that overflow room. It was a weird feeling, to be perfectly honest. I have not been down at the courthouse for the rest of the trial. Editorially, we kind of made the decision in the Boise State Public Radio newsroom that, you know, we're going to cover the big rocks of this case, but we're, you know, we don't have the resources, to be perfectly blunt. And you know, we're going to stay away from the finer points of that. There are plenty of good reporters who are doing that work already. So yesterday was my first time down there, and it did feel a little bit weird to me. The judge started the day by dismissing the defense's motion from earlier in the week, asking for a Rule 29 review. And this basically says, from the defense, we don't think prosecutors have laid out enough evidence to even get close to proving their case. And it asks the court to review that. And Judge Stephen Boyce spent about 20 minutes or so going through kind of the finer points of what witnesses said, what evidence was presented, and dismissing those for each case, each count against Lori Vallow Daybell, and then denying the motion in full. They moved on to closing arguments. The state laid out its case in summary, which it's, I would say, fairly difficult to summarize 4+ weeks of testimony, but they did that in about an hour. They spent a fair amount of time looking back at some of the, at a lot of the digital evidence that was presented, the digital footprints that links who was where, when, some of the search history of the alleged co-conspirators with Lori Vallow Daybell, namely Alex Cox, her brother, who died shortly after the alleged crimes were committed, and linking the three of them together, and going back over the fact for jurors that Vallow Daybell never did report her kids missing, and continued to collect the Social Security survivors benefits that were being paid to Tylee Ryan and JJ Vallow following the deaths of their family members. She switched the bank accounts allegedly a day before they think that the kids were killed, and continue to get those. So that point is what ties her to the accusations of grand theft, which is just one of the charges that she faced. When the defense took its turn, Jim Archibald, who did the closing for Vallow Daybell's defense, tried to poke holes in a lot of those motives. Prosecutor said she did it for money, and Archibald contended, well, Lori Vallow's late husband, Charles Vallow, was a mid six-figure annual earner. And Chad Daybell was somewhat of a failed author who was broke or who didn't earn very much money. Why would she have done that? Prosecutors alleged that she did it for power and for sex. And Archibald contended in one of the more odd moments of the defense, to be honest, he said, have you looked at pictures of Charles Vallow and of Chad Daybell? Was she trading up or trading down? Trying to call into question exactly what her motivations might have been. That was an odd moment. And, you know, I will say throughout portions of the defense's closing arguments, which is really the most that we've heard from the defense, they didn't call witnesses in the case at all. The folks in the overflow room were laughing or scoffing, or in the case of, you know, asking to compare photos of the two men, there was an audible gasp when that happened. At the end of the day, Archibald's main point was that the evidence to directly tie Vallow, you know, there were no text messages saying today's the day that we're going to take out the kids. There was nothing that linked her directly to an order to do that, and therefore she should be found not guilty. The jury got the case about 3 o'clock after prosecutors had a chance to rebut, and they had dinner at the courthouse yesterday. Called it a day about 9 o'clock. About 8 o'clock last night. They returned at 9 a.m. this morning, and now in about a half an hour, we'll get a verdict.
Mm-hmm. So if we think about that, they got the trial. I mean, it went to the jury, as you said, about 3 o'clock yesterday. Go home at 8, so that's about 5 hours with a lunch break, so probably 4. And so, I mean, we're talking less than 7 hours of deliberations, potentially, Troy. And
yeah, that seems like an appropriate ballpark.
Right. And we can all sit here in armchair quarterback, right, about like, oh, well, this could mean this or this could mean that. I think at the end of the day, you know, the takeaway is two children were brutally, brutally killed. And it's fascinating to me what you said the defense really focused on in that closing argument, instead of trying to maybe poke holes in the fact that, you know, she wasn't responsible for the deaths of her two children. So, Troy, let's go back to the prosecutors and their closing argument, because my understanding is, I mean, that was a big part of their closing argument, to the point of even putting these pictures up again, that I cannot fathom even seeing those in person of the remains of these children.
No, the photos are as horrendous as advertised, as people generally depicted them from earlier moments in the trial. They came up without much warning during the closing arguments yesterday. There were only a handful, but they're certainly enough to convey that image. And I think I had not seen them previously, and the unimaginable cruelty in the way that the two children were killed is hard to put it into words, even having 24 hours to think about it. It's really hard. The prosecutors painted the children to Lori Vallow Daybell as an obstacle to be moved out of the way so she could spend her life with Chad. They really came at it from that position. She did what she did. She moved to Idaho from Arizona in the first place to essentially take herself and the kids and her brother away from prying eyes so that they could work on eliminating the children. She made moves financially to connect her bank account to the Social Security benefits before the children were the day investigators think that they were killed. Chad Daybell allegedly bumped the death benefit for his wife at the time, Tammy Daybell, the benefit of her life insurance just before she was killed. All these things sort of lined up, aimed at proving the conspiracy between Vallow, between Chad Daybell, who she married about a month after the children, a month and a half or so after both children had died. And then Alex Cox, her brother, who prosecutors say was present when the children were killed.
Mm-hmm. So, folks, if you're just joining us, Troy was in the courthouse yesterday during closing arguments. And we have now been told that there is a verdict. It will be read at 12:45. It will be read live. There still will not be video in the courtroom, but it will be read live. There actually will also be a still photographer in the courtroom. The judge is allowing that as well. So, Scott, I think it's very obvious to say that the United States is struggling with a fentanyl crisis. And Idaho is no exception to that. And you recently wrote an opinion piece about Idaho's problem when it comes to fentanyl. But in that article, Scott, you know, you very bluntly called out Governor Little for basically limiting who can access medication that can save lives if someone has overdosed. So talk a little bit about, first off, I mean, this true crisis that we are facing, but then in a lot of ways, it could be argued not a lot is being done to try to stop it.
Right. Well, so Governor Little marked Fentanyl Awareness Day on Tuesday with an event down in CUNA. And for sure, fentanyl is a big problem. It's a dangerous drug. It's killing tens of thousands of people every year, Americans every year. And Governor Little, you know, is very right to mark fentanyl awareness. During his presentation on Tuesday, he announced a few things. He announced an anti-drug media campaign called Fentanyl Takes All, trying to deter fentanyl use and you know, highlighting the dangers of fentanyl. He also announced that there would be more roadside testing equipment to help the Idaho State Police get fentanyl off the streets more quickly. He announced a couple other things and highlighted, you know, the dangers of fentanyl. This session, I did point out in this column that during this session, Governor Little signed a bill, and it was really a part of a bill, as part of the spending bill for the Department of Health and Welfare. And part of that bill limits the number and limits the people who can get naloxone kits. And naloxone is this anti-overdose antidote, that if somebody is overdosing on an opioid, that someone can administer naloxone, which often comes in a nasal spray, very easily and can save lives. And the reasons for adding this in were really kind of inane. They were talking about increasing training, and like I said, it's a nasal spray and doesn't really need any training, limiting those who can get naloxone. Governor Little even admitted in his transmittal letter that this will likely lead to more overdose deaths. So that's troubling. And then also during his presentation on Tuesday, he announced that he is preparing to travel to the Mexico-Texas border in 2 weeks to deploy a team of Idaho State Police personnel to assist the state of Texas on a month-long mission for drug and fentanyl interdiction efforts at the border. And in doing so, he cited the expiration of Title 42, which it's a COVID-era health preventative executive order allowed the United States to send back folks at the border. That is expiring, and some people think that this is going to increase the number of illegal border crossings, and that's what Governor Little cited. But I did a little bit of digging, and despite what you may have heard, the vast majority of fentanyl seizures at the border are made up of U.S. citizens traveling through legal cross points, not undocumented immigrants. The Cato Institute, which is a libertarian think tank, they did a study of drug seizures and fentanyl sentencings in 2021. And in that year, U.S. citizens made up 86.3% of convicted fentanyl drug traffickers, 10 times greater than the convictions of illegal immigrants for the same offense. That same study also found that just 0.02% of the people arrested by Border Patrol for crossing the U.S.-Mexico border illegally possessed any fentanyl whatsoever. So this notion, and, you know, folks talk about open border, and for sure, immigration is a big problem that we need to solve. But if we think that immigrants who are crossing the border illegally are the source of fentanyl, that is absolutely wrong. That is not what's happening at all. And to send Idaho State Police officers down to monitor illegal border crossings in an effort to fight fentanyl is really a fool's errand and a misguided effort. And I would say, you know, a misdirected use of Idaho taxpayer funds.
Oh, right, because it doesn't get to the heart of the issue and making sure that more Idahoans don't die from this.
Right.
Yeah. So, Will, I want to bring you into the conversation. We know that so many organizations, you know, places, businesses, nonprofits are still recovering from the impact of the pandemic. You recently reported, though, on something that I personally had not really thought of, but it makes sense. We're also seeing a lack of people volunteering. And I'm curious about this. So tell us about what you found out in regards to volunteering and how it was impacted by the pandemic.
Sure. So AmeriCorps and the U.S. Census Bureau compile data every 2 years about volunteering and civic life throughout the United States. And yeah, like you said, they found a pretty major drop in volunteering, a 7-point drop between 2019 and 2021. That's the largest drop since they started tracking volunteerism back in the early 2000s. So it's a pretty big drop. As far as reasons for that, there's several. COVID-19 was huge. A lot of older folks didn't feel safe, you know, getting out of the house, right? So that could lead to some of the drops. Also, it was a tough time economically. You know, inflation's high, and when it's tough times economically, you might need to take some time doing other things as opposed to volunteering, where, you know, the whole point is you don't make any money. So there was a lot of that going on. You know, time will tell if this is sort of a blip on the radar in volunteerism, or if this is another part of a long-term trend. And one thing that some folks noted during this data sort of analysis period was actually volunteering has been declining for decades, even prior to the pandemic. You know, the way people interact with society is just changing. You know, we're also seeing decreases in other local collective action, you know, things like unionization. In contrast, people might be voting more. They're also more likely to do some individual type of service. Like, you know, they might even boycott a product or boycott a service based on their political values. So the way that people are, you know, engaging civically is changing. One thing I will note is the Mountain West remains a place where people tend to volunteer at above average rates. Idaho is included in that. Also, Utah, Montana, and Wyoming, you know, people here do have higher rates than average of volunteering. We also have higher rates of average in what's called informal help, which is just like helping out your neighbors, things like that, and also in giving financially to charities. So
That's super interesting. Troy, so there was news, I believe it was late 2022, about a potential merger with Albertsons and Kroger. Any news on this? Because there was a lot of backlash when this announcement was made.
Yeah, there was. And I think that backlash is going to continue. There was a study released from a left-leaning think tank in Washington, D.C. that basically looked at how combining the two companies into around 5,000 stores, and they'll probably have to spin off several hundred to satisfy regulators, what that does to market concentration for workers. And what the study found was that workers would take a wage hit because there are fewer companies to employ workers, and there's the grocery market is just more concentrated. Kroger did not appreciate the results of that study. They said it basically ignores the commitment that they've made publicly to push $1 billion in spending to their employees going forward. And, you know, so it's still back and forth on what a merger between the two companies is really going to look like for the workers who are largely unionized across the country. There was also news just this week that the Kroger CEO came out and preemptively said, if regulators tell us we cannot complete this merger, we do intend to sue to make sure that we can go forward. And this is a little unique within that space. Normally, you don't have the threat of a lawsuit even before the regulatory review has happened. But they are very bullish on this, I guess you could say. And they think it should go forward and it will go forward. And so that news came out this week. Other than that, the review process is still in the early stages. The planned merger isn't until next year when they think it would be able to be completed. And there's still no idea. There's competing data from different places on exactly how many stores that a merged company would have to spin off to satisfy regulators.
Joining us for this segment, Nicole Blanchard, outdoors reporter for the Idaho Statesman. Some news came out the other day in regards to grizzly bears, and this is the state of Idaho is threatening to sue the federal government if the grizzly bears are not delisted from the endangered species list. Tell us what in the world is going on with this.
Sure, Gemma. So on Wednesday, Governor Brad Little and Attorney General Raul Labrador sent a notice of intent to sue to the director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and to the Secretary of Interior, and letting them know if you guys don't delist bears within 60 days, basically we're going to file a lawsuit at you for violating the Endangered Species Act. So grizzly bears in Alaska are not considered endangered, but here in the lower 48 states, they have been protected off and on since the 1970s. And there have been a couple different distinct recovery zones, a couple of which are in or partially in Idaho. And that has prevented Idaho Fish and Game from managing grizzly bears. It's all under the federal government. And it has also prevented any kind of hunting season on them here in Idaho. And this has kind of been going on for a while. Last year, Brad Little sent a petition to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And the argument has been, you know, these bears that are in the lower 48 states, they don't constitute a distinct population segment. So there's really no standing to protect them under the Endangered Species Act. And that's the same argument that they are making in the notice of intent to sue that they filed this week.
So where does it go from here then? We're just waiting to find out what happens next.
Basically, yes. So there's a couple other pieces kind of in motion. So the governors of Montana and Wyoming also filed petitions last year, but theirs were much more narrow. So Idaho's petition was basically take all of the lower 48 bears off the endangered species list because they aren't qualified to be there. Montana and Wyoming took a different tack and they said, we have these distinct population segments. In Montana, it's the Continental Divide. In Wyoming, it's the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem, which also trails into eastern Idaho. And they've said these populations are recovered. These specific recovery zones should no longer count under the Endangered Species Act. And the Fish and Wildlife Service in February said, you know what, those are legitimate claims. We're going to take a look at those and see how valid they are. So those two claims are kind of moving along. But the Fish and Wildlife Service has already rejected Idaho's argument once. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes.
Okay. And let's now, Nicole, switch and talk about wolves, because the Idaho Fish and Game Commission just approved a new wolf management plan. And this would potentially slash what? We're talking 2/3 of our state's wolf population?
Just about that, yeah. So we currently, I should say, as of 2022, Fish and Game estimated the wolf population to be a little over 1,300 animals. And under this new management plan, by 2028, they are hoping to have the statewide population down to just 500 wolves.
Oh, wow. Okay. And so this is going into effect.
It is, yes. So they debuted this in January at a commission meeting as a draft management plan to public comments. And yesterday, the commission voted unanimously that, yes, they will put this into effect.
Okay. So, Will, let's now talk a little bit about wildlife corridors and conserving these corridors. Nicole briefly mentioned this, but you recently did a whole piece on Idaho's push to conserve these corridors around Yellowstone. So update us on this.
Yeah, what this is a part of is the USDA's Conservation Reserve Program. What that is essentially saying, hey, we as the United States of America really value not only our open spaces and our working agricultural lands, but also the ability for our wildlife to move, and not just those controversial predators that Nicole was just talking about, but also mule deer, pronghorn antelope, you know, things like that. And around the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, we know Yellowstone's a big area, but a lot of those migrating animals leave into parts of eastern Idaho, Montana, and a huge part of my state, which is western Wyoming. What these programs are is they essentially pay usually working ranchers in the case of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem to they can still hay, they can still work their lands, they can still even graze a little bit of cattle on their lands, but they have to maintain some ecosystem stewardship. So they need to maintain the grasslands and the soils. They need to allow migrating wildlife to move through. And this is a program that is, growing in popularity quite a bit. There were 3.1 million acres around the U.S. that that were added last year, and they're expecting a lot more people interested this year. I think it shows that working ranchers, especially in our region, are very interested in wildlife and in conserving and trying to find a financial and economic way to continue their way of life, which is ranching, and it's becoming more expensive. And in this case, and in the case of Idaho, you know, a certain part of Idaho is available to join this grassland conservation program. So specifically counties like Teton County, Bonneville County, Fremont County, those areas, if you live there, you'll get special consideration if you apply. And a lot of what you already do as a rancher will be something that you can continue doing, and you'll get paid for it. So it's an interesting program.
Yeah, absolutely. Scott, I've got about 3 minutes left, and I want to talk a little bit more. I believe we talked about this once before, but now it seems to actually that it's going to happen. Fill us in as to why four Idaho churches are actually going to leave the United Methodist Church.
Right. Yeah, this is a national story that we now know is going to have local and state impact. This is a, I don't want to call it a schism, but it is a division in the United Methodist Church. And this is over the issue of homosexuality, and it has to do with church doctrine and whether the church should have gay clergy and perform same-sex marriages. And so about 3,000 churches now out of 30,000, so we're up to about 10% of the churches nationwide have left the United Methodist Church. Primarily conservative churches are leaving the United Methodist Church because they don't believe that churches should have gay clergy or perform same-sex marriages. And so last weekend, there were two special sessions in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho to hear requests for what they call disaffiliations. This is requests from churches that want to leave the United Methodist Church over this issue. And in those special sessions, four churches in Idaho were granted permission to disaffiliate. And one of them is local. It's a local church, the United Methodist, the Eagle United Methodist Church, otherwise known as Eagle Hills Church, has disaffiliated. Another church in Castleford, outside of Buell in Twin Falls County, and then two churches in North Idaho, in Kendrick and in Orofino, disaffiliated. During those same conferences, one church in Oregon disaffiliated in Fossil, Oregon, and 11 churches in Washington State are leaving. And so this is a growing schism. Like I said, we're up to, last time I talked about this, it was about 7% of churches, and now there's 10% of the churches have disaffiliated. And there's a deadline for the end of the year, so we might see even more, and we might see more locally in Idaho, Oregon, and Washington as well before the year is up.
As we mentioned, there is a verdict in the criminal trial of Lori Vallow-Daybell. She is the Idaho mother whose children's disappearance and fringe religious beliefs gained a lot of national and international attention. We have been told that the verdict is coming down at 12:45. It is 12:44 right now. But as we are waiting, Troy, you're joining me here. As we mentioned, you were in the courthouse yesterday. But sometimes these things don't go exactly as planned right at 12:45. So as we are waiting, I do kind of want to continue our Friday Reporter Roundtable because there's a story that you covered recently that's gained some attention. And explain this to us. So the J.R. Simplot Company is being sued for allegedly polluting the Snake River?
Yeah, this ties back to the Simplot Company's feedlot in Grandview. This is about 60 miles south of Boise, and it's a lot that's existed for a long time. And basically, it's 750 acres. They have a capacity of around 150,000 head that they can have down there, livestock, mainly cattle. And the Simplot Company uses their processing scraps as their processing food to prepare and sell to us in grocery stores. Some of the leftover gets processed into cattle feed, and ranchers can bring their head to this feedlot to get fed. They say it's high quality food. They specialize in finishing cattle. So we're fattening up cattle before they go to market, sort of thing. A nonprofit advocacy group called Snake River Waterkeeper got a tip from a recreator, I was told, sometime around 5 or 6 years ago that the water in the snake at this area was highly contaminated. They pulled a sample from some of the tributary ditches and canals that kind of abut and come off this feedlot property that feed into the Snake River that's nearby. It's not right next to it, but it's nearby. They pulled some water samples first in 2017. They came back. They did a handful of additional samples from publicly accessible spots in the area last year. They did these at different times of year, so water levels were high at some points and low at others. They had these evaluated by a lab, a Boise-based lab, and what they found was immediately downriver of where these streams, or canals and ditches feed into the snake, and in some of these canals and ditches directly, there were significantly elevated levels of E. coli and fecal coliform contamination, essentially runoff from animal waste that was getting into the river. That feedlot had a permit under the Federal Clean Water Act that expired in 2012. And the Snake River Waterkeeper folks say, if you don't have a permit, you essentially are saying, we don't pollute. We don't discharge any contaminated water whatsoever. They say that their water tests disprove that, and they've sued. They're asking a court to block Simplot from continuing to pollute and fine the company more than $100 million, basically a daily fine of around $60,000 going back 5 years. Wow. To the date of their first water test.
So with that said, though, Troy, where are they then with this lawsuit?
So it was just filed this week. Simplot has a period of time to respond. Based on court documents, it looks like they already have. A Simplot spokesman didn't have any comment for me when asked. They don't comment on pending litigation, which is no surprise there. But it's in the very early stages of this, and I don't have a sense of how this might go. Buck Ryan, who is the founder and director of Snake River Waterkeeper, said, you know, there's a lot of recreating, and obviously the fishery and the snake is affected by this pollution as well. And there's nothing else in this area that could explain the level of pollution that they've found. It is tied to this large feedlot. So we'll see where it goes, but it's in the very early stages.
Okay. So Troy, let's get back to the verdict in the Lori Vallow-Daybell trial. And just to give people some context, I mean, I would assume a lot of people know about this, but there might be some folks who do not. This is basically a case that goes back almost 4 years when this mom in Rexburg, the grandparents of her adopted child, were trying to do a welfare check because they hadn't heard from their 7-year-old grandson. They lived in Louisiana, the Daybells lived in Rexburg. And very long story and convoluted story short, it was found that Lori Daybell's two of her children, her two youngest children, JJ, who she and her former husband had adopted, JJ, was 7 years old. Tylee, her daughter from another marriage, who I believe was 16 at the time, were missing and ultimately ended up finding their bodies on Chad Daybell's property. And so here we are, Troy, that we have now spent in whole 5 weeks in a trial. The first week was seating a jury. 4 weeks, more than 60 witnesses. And Troy, as we mentioned earlier in the program, you were in the courtroom yesterday during closing arguments. What was the mood like in the courthouse? Because we've spoken with Nate Eaton at East Idaho News, who has followed this from the beginning. And, you know, he has talked a lot about like that energy in the courtroom and, and just, I mean, almost stress, right? Anxiety, it feels like. Did you feel that at all?
I did. I absolutely did. And like I said earlier, this hour, the overflow room, which is where I was yesterday, where they're broadcasting a video stream, there were probably around 150 people in there. It was the most crowded it's been during the trial, according to a bailiff I talked to in the room. And there's palpable tension. You can feel people, you know, wanting this to go a certain way. There was somebody handing out bracelets. I didn't get a good read on exactly what that was about. In line as we were waiting to get into the courthouse that morning. And as a reporter, I declined. And the woman asked me, she said, "Well, you aren't rooting for our side." And I said, "No, I don't have a side. I'm here to work." But you know, there is a sense that the people who have taken time out of their day to come down and see these proceedings in person, they are deeply interested in finding the outcome of this case and in a large sense, getting justice for the victims here. It does appear, and I'm watching the stream, it does appear that Lori Vallet Daybell has reentered the courtroom and taken a seat at the defense. I still do not see Judge Boyce on the stream here, so we're still a few minutes away.
Yeah, I'm looking at the same thing, Troy. And as you mentioned, Lori Daybell is in the courtroom. She is surrounded by her two attorneys. And it is a packed courtroom once again, as you mentioned, Troy, waiting for Judge Stephen Boyce to enter the courtroom so that this verdict can be read. And I have to say, it's a bit disconcerting to actually see video in this trial, because the judge did not allow cameras in the courtroom for the entire trial. So now to see this courtroom, to see Lori Daybell, you know, at the defense table with her attorneys, it really kind of hits home, Troy, that this is real, that this has been happening for so long. And I know that might seem silly, but it makes it real looking at this actual video.
It does, and I think that's a fair point. I mean, there were so many details, and the judge is now entering the courtroom. We're essentially looking at a Zoom feed here on this stream.
Right.
There's one camera that is facing the gallery. There's one camera that is framed on the defense table, and Judge
Troy,
Stephen Boyce is now going to be speaking to the to the court.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. We are going on the record. I'm the court reporter. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. This is case CR 22-21-1624, State of Idaho versus Noreen Vallet. The matter before the court today is for a verdict in the jury trial that's been conducted over the last several weeks in this case. The court will note on the record, prosecution is here represented by Mr. Wood, Ms. Blake, and Ms. Smith. The defense, Mr. Archibald, Mr. Thomas are present, as well as the defendant who is present. The court's been advised that the jury has reached a verdict at this time Is the state ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is the defense ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well. Let's have the jurors brought in, please. All right. The court will note that we had alternate jurors that were excused upon deliberation. So now the remaining 12 jurors who have deliberated are here and appear to all be properly seated. Will counsel stipulate that the jury is all present and properly seated from the state?
Yes, Your Honor.
Will the defense will stipulate?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. At this time, the court will inquire then from the jury. Has the jury reached a verdict?
Yeah.
Very well. If you have the verdict form, I'd ask the bailiff bring that over here and we'll have it brought to the clerk to be read.
So the judge is right, looking at the verdict right now before it is announced.
Completed, signed and dated. So at this time, I'll direct the clerk to please read the verdict into the record. The defendant would please rise.
In the District Court of the 7th Judicial District of the State of Idaho, in and for the County of Fremont, State of Idaho Plaintiff versus Lori Noreen Ballow, aka Lori Noreen Daybell Defendant, case number CR22211624. Verdict. We, the jury, duly impaneled and sworn to try the above entitled action for our verdict, unanimously answer the questions submitted to us as follows. Question number one. In regards to count one of the amended indictment, is Lori Noreen Ballow not guilty or guilty of conspiracy to commit first-degree murder of Tylee Ryan and grand theft by deception? Answer, guilty. Question number two. In regards to count two of the amended indictment, is Lori Noreen Ballow not guilty or guilty of first-degree murder of Tylee Ryan? Answer, guilty. Question number three, in regards to count three of the amended indictment, is Lori Noreen Ballow not guilty or guilty of conspiracy to commit first-degree murder of Joshua Jackson Ballow and grand theft by deception? Answer, guilty. Question number four, in regards to count four of the amended indictment, is Lori Noreen Ballow not guilty or guilty of first-degree murder of Joshua Jackson Ballow? Answer, guilty. Question number five. In regards to count five of the amended indictment, is Lori Noreen Ballow not guilty or guilty of conspiracy to commit first-degree murder of Tammy Daybell? Answer, guilty. Question number six. In regards to count seven of the amended indictment, is Lori Noreen Ballow not guilty or guilty of grand theft? Answer, guilty. Dated this 12th day of May, 2023, signed by the presiding officer.
All right, please be seated. Madam Clerk, thank you for reading.
And that was the verdict in the criminal trial of Lori Ballow Daybell, as you heard, guilty on all charges. I want to thank you for joining us today on Idaho Matters. I thank our reporter roundtable for joining us as well. Big thank you to our senior producer, Samantha Wright and Hannah Gardosky, and everyone else in our news department who stepped up to make sure that we got this verdict on the air for all of you today. I'm Gemma Gaudet. It is Friday. It's a beautiful day. Enjoy your weekend. We'll see you back here Monday. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudet. We'll see you tomorrow.
What if the greatest tragedy of your life was just covered up?
I've never seen anything like that before or after.
This is the story of the worst marine-on-marine friendly fire in modern history, a story kept from the public.
It's like, what did y'all have to hide?
Listen to NPR's Embedded podcast in its latest series, Taking Cover.